This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the main reason for his visit is that he will be guest of honor at the 14th of July Bastille Day celebrations. It's the annual National Day celebration for France. It commemorates, of course, the fall of the Bastille during the French Revolution.
That's Catherine Field in Paris reporting on President Trump's visit to France. Details coming up.
Also in Nigeria and Cameroon, suicide bomb attacks kill more than 30 people this week, and 38 more mass graves have been discovered in the Kasai region of the DRC, bringing the total to more than 80.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, suicide bomb attacks killed more than 30 people in Nigeria and Cameroon this week. First, in Nigeria, police say the death toll has risen to at least 23 after four female suicide bombers attacked the Maiduguri suburb of Malai Tuesday night. AFP reports the bombers targeted a funeral ceremony. Most of the victims were from the vigilante group called the Civilian Joint Task Force. The death toll also includes seven villagers and the four bombers. About 23 people were injured. And in Cameroon, Reuters reports a suicide bomber killed at least 12 people and wounded over 40 others last night. A baby was among the victims. An army spokesman says the attack occurred in Waza, a small town near the Nigerian border. A second suicide bomber was shot dead before the explosives could be detonated. Both attacks are blamed on Boko Haram militants.
A top UN human rights official says the DRC government must identify all those responsible for the ongoing violence in the Kasai region. The UN Human Rights Director in the DRC, Jose Maria Aranaz, says 38 more mass graves have been discovered, bringing the total to more than 80. AFP reports he describes claims that rogue elements of security forces are responsible as unconvincing. He says it's essential an inquiry not only investigates those who committed the killings, but also any politician and military personnel who may have ordered them. The Catholic Church says more than 3,000 people have died in the Kasai region as government troops fight local militia. More than 1 million have been displaced. The violence began last year when a tribal chieftain openly challenged the authority of President Joseph Kabila's government.
President Trump arrived in Paris today ahead of tomorrow's Bastille Day celebrations. In fact, Trump is the guest of honor. But ahead of tomorrow's festivities, French President Emmanuel Macron is busy today launching the G5 Sahel Alliance. The alliance is made up of military forces from Chad, Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, and Mauritania. It will combat terror threats in the region. Macron is hoping for financial support from Germany. Reporter Catherine Field is following developments. From Paris, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua first about President Trump's visit.
The main reason for his visit is that he will be guest of honor at the 14th of July Bastille Day celebrations. It's the annual National Day celebration for France. It commemorates, of course, the fall of the Bastille during the French Revolution. The reason that Donald Trump is here is because it's exactly 100 years ago since the Americans joined the First World War. It was very late in coming in to help out the Allies in the First World War, but it was a vital time. It was really the time when France was almost on its knees. And as we get into this next 1 year of commemorations of the American involvement in the Western Front of the First World War, you're going to see just how crucial the American presence was. And it really did save Paris from falling. And that's why I think you're not going to see the big demonstrations against America that you saw, say, last week at the G20, because this is really France remembering that great alliance that they had with the United States. States, that transatlantic alliance that went through two world wars in the 20th century, that the French are really still, despite the fact they're a bit perplexed about President Trump, but the French are still very grateful for the commitment the Americans made in the world wars.
And of course, Americans are grateful to France for the help it gave during the American Revolution.
Indeed. I mean, when you look at the relationship between France and America, it's been going on for a very long time. There's been ups and downs, but France has also then helped out in Afghanistan. It's also had a role in the Korean War. This is a very long-standing relationship, and yes, it's had its ups and downs. A lot of people in France were querying where America was going when there was George W. Bush as president, and there have been questions about where America is going now with President Trump. But what the French president is hoping to do is that if you keep a channel of conversation even just going with the White House, then you are more likely to have some sort of influence, particularly when it comes to the fight against terrorism and in particular with what's happening with Syria. If you keep that channel open, then you may well just be able to influence the American decision-making process. And in particular, what Emmanuel Macron, the French president, is hoping is that somehow he will be able to bring U.S. President Trump background to rethinking his pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, because that really is a diplomatic triumph, and they still cannot believe that the United States has pulled out of that Paris Climate Accord.
Now, on another matter, the French president is launching his new Sahel alliance to try to combat terrorism in that part of Africa. Tell us about that.
To the heart of what Emmanuel Macron believes should be happening in the Sahel, which is that it's not just a matter of getting troops together again to fight the threat from insurgents in that area, but also the need to have education facilities there. And in fact, if we just look at what he's been saying in the last couple of days about the Sahel, he's been talking about the lack of education, the lack of development, and long-term investment in the Sahel region. So that's what he's hoping for there. When we have a look at the sort of money that the French Development Agency is putting into Africa, it is quite a lot. They put in last year 9.4 billion euros. So that clearly is their priority area. But by having this alliance in the Sahel, he's trying to make it far more of an international commitment to the Sahel. It's going to be difficult, though, Joe, because there is a feeling that the Sahel is a region that is really just for France to look after. This is France's, if you like, backyard. And a lot of the, particularly the European countries, don't like to get involved with it. So far, all we've had is an involvement from the European Union. They've put in a sizable amount of money, but certainly we've not seen any of the other bilateral investments that Emmanuel Macron still hopes he'll be able to bring to the table.
That's reporter Catherine Field in Paris. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
'16 was a deadly year for those trying to protect the environment. The watchdog group Global Witness says at least 200 people were killed last year defending their land, forests, and rivers from mining, logging, and agricultural companies. The group says that's twice the number of journalists killed last year. Global Witness says the trend is growing and spreading, with murders now reported in 24 countries. That's compared to 16 in 2015. It says mining is the bloodiest trade, with at least 33 murders. Brazil remains the most deadly country for those protecting the environment, with 49 murders. Global Witness says governments, companies, and investors have a duty to guarantee that activists are protected from violence and that those responsible for the killings are brought to justice.
In South Sudan President Salva Kiir has sacked some judges who went on strike 2 months ago. Media reports say the number of judges who were fired ranged from 10 to 17. The judges had demanded higher pay and judicial system reform. They had accused the Chief Justice of interfering in the judicial system through his appointments. Reuters quotes the Deputy Information Minister as saying the striking judges had denied people justice. He says their grievances should have been resolved through administrative channels. A spokesman for the judges say they want to hear from lawmakers on the matter. The judges had been paid about $25 a month.
A new report finds more than 2 billion people lack access to safe drinking water, and more than twice that number lack safe sanitation. The report by the World Health Organization and UN Children's Fund is the first global assessment of water, sanitation, and hygiene for the Sustainable Development Goals. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United Nations reports nearly 850,000 people die every year from lack of access to good water, sanitation, and hygiene. This includes more than 360,000 children under age 5 who die from diarrhea and many others from diseases such as cholera, dysentery, hepatitis A, and typhoid. The joint report by the World Health Organization and UN Children's Fund finds people living in rural areas in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia are most at risk of disease and death from poor water and sanitation-related sources. WHO Coordinator for Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene, Bruce Gordon, says this report is the first to assess the importance of hygiene to good health. He says many homes, healthcare facilities, and schools have no soap and water for hand washing.
The one figure I'd like to kind of emphasize here is that in sub-Saharan Africa, 15% of the population only has access to a hand washing facility with soap and water. And as we know, good hygiene is one of the simplest and most effective ways to stop the spread of disease.
One of the UN's 17 Sustainable Development Goals calls for universal and equitable access to safe water and sanitation for all by 2030. UNICEF Chief of Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene, Sanjay Wijsekera, says such progress would have a knock-on effect on other development areas.
For children, access to safe water, sanitation, and hygiene not only keeps them alive and healthy, but it gives them a chance to go to school and gain an education, reduces inequalities, and it just gives them a fair start to life.
The SDGs are calling for an end to open defecation, which perpetuates a vicious cycle of disease and poverty. Open defecation is practiced by more than 890 million people, mainly in rural areas, who have no toilet or latrine. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, Kenya is less than a month from nationwide voting, and the Electoral Commission remains under pressure. The commission is appealing a high court order that it has to reopen bidding for the printing of presidential ballots a week before it was set to start, even as the opposition prepares to take the commission to court on another issue. Meanwhile, the voter registry continues to spark debate and confusion. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports.
When Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission opened a short message platform 2 weeks ago so the public could check voter details, many, like Florence, a businesswoman, used it and found her details were correct, but not those of her sibling. She says her sister checked her details and found her identification number was registered to another person, and she was a registered voter in Kiambu, Gatundu East, while she is a registered voter at Buruburu in Nairobi. She went to where she registered as a voter, and they put her name back. She was furious. Many Kenyans sent random numbers or incomplete digits, but they were still registered, raising questions on the credibility of the register. Electoral Body Commissioner Roslyn Akombe defended her organization.
What we have seen is that in a majority of those cases, people are putting in maybe their correct national ID numbers, but that's not probably what we have in the system, because maybe a number has been transposed. And so when they try to put in the information, it doesn't come out, but it does not mean that they are not in the register.
The audit firm KPMG, which was hired to clean the register, found 90,000 dead voters on the rolls and another 500,000 people who used wrong or inconsistent ID numbers. The electoral body says it has removed at least 88,000 dead voters from the list. Florist Simon Musungu says the voter register must be published. The register should be published so that everyone can verify their details. That will benefit the IEBC too. They cannot know everything. There is a problem because one vote matters. Even if one person does not vote, you deny him his rights. The Electoral Commission and the opposition have been battling in the courts on matters dealing the cancellation of the presidential ballot papers by the High Court. The Electoral Commission is appealing that decision. The opposition is asking the court to rule on what means of ballot counting and transmitting the results should be used. In December, the Parliament passed a law allowing the IEBC to use manual voting and transmission in case the electronic technology fails. The head of the Electoral Law and Governance Institute in Africa, Felix Odhiambo, says the failures of the past are haunting the Commission.
IEBC is yet to demonstrate that technology will work. Remember, in 2013, despite the assurances by the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, the technology failed. So, as we speak, the Elections Act talks of technology to be put in place 60 days to the elections, tested, and its workability ascertained. But as we speak, the IEBC has not contested these gadgets. So the opinion is still divided as to whether they'll work or not.
Political observers predict a close contest between the incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta and former Prime Minister Raila Odinga. Many hope the August 8th elections will be free, fair and credible to avoid violence similar to that in 2008. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A Kenyan charity is working to prevent violence as the country goes to the polls in August. The Shalom Center for Conflict Resolution and Reconciliation was founded in response to post-election violence in 2007. The group empowers communities in volatile regions to keep the peace and encourages warring groups to lay down their arms. It focuses mostly on ethnic communities in northern Kenya, near the border with war-torn Somalia and South Sudan, as well as in urban slums around Nairobi. Father Patrick Devine, an Irish Catholic priest, is the founder of the Shalom Center. VOA's Ruben Chama asked him how the idea got started.
Well, I first came to Africa in 1988. An Irishman, an Irish missionary, and began working in Western Tanzania. In the course of the last 29 years, I've had many, many different experiences in the realm of peace and development. When I look back on issues of conflict in Africa, I was particularly touched by the conflict that happened in Rwanda in 1994 and the disastrous impact that had on the people there and on the country and on the social, political, economic prosperity of the people. Then in my own career, I have ended up in a lot of roles of administration through the Religious Superiors Conference of Kenya, which would have been made up of approximately 5,000 personnel spread all over Eastern Africa. And during my time in that role as chairman and as the chief executive, the secretary general, I became aware of many, many conflict environments where people were killed and maimed and displaced persistently. And I looked at the role of the church and a lot of NGOs, and predominantly, they were very, very good at addressing the symptoms of conflict, the symptoms of poverty, the symptoms of migration. But very few had the skill sets or the qualifications to address the underlying causes. And I began to ask myself, after around 25 years working here, engaged in development projects, water, schools, hospitals, etc., did I wish to spend another 25 years just dealing with the symptoms, or did I really want to tackle the underlying causes? And it was out of that mindset that the Shalom Center for Conflict Resolution and Reconciliation was founded.
Could you give us some of these underlying factors, economic, historical, and maybe religious, that, for example, have influenced the solution one of the conflicts your group is actually addressing?
Take, for example, in the northern Kenya, in the area where Kenya interfaces with Somalia, Ethiopia, South Sudan and Uganda. Some of the key problems causing interethnic conflict are around the following issues. Of course, core resources, which is really to do with environmental resources. Not just their scarcity, but also the management of what they have. Second, in some of the conflicts, you have issues of cultural variation. Different cultures and different issues creating clashes between the people based on their own cultural traditions. Thirdly, you have contested territory, customary land mostly, contested territory about access to water and pasture. Fourthly is the whole area of infrastructure insecurity, the lack of institutions in terms of roads, communications, law and order, legal redress, medical education, all of these things which are crucial to help people to meet their basic human needs and to actualize their potential. And you put all that into a boiling pot together, you get a social pressure cooker, right, generating conflict. And that also is contaminated by the proliferation of small arms. So there's not one monocausal explanation. It's a multiplicity and it needs a multidisciplinary approach. And that's why Shalom has people with qualifications from many disciplines who are committed to working persistently inside in the conflict environment.
Kenya is gearing up for another election next month. Could you share with us some of the initiatives as Kenya heads for the next election?
Apart from working up in this northern area of Kenya and where it interfaces with the surrounding countries, we're also very, very involved in the slum areas, the poor areas of urban cities here, particularly in Nairobi, Kibera, Matare, Kariobangi area, also in Nakuru, Naivasha, places where were the hot spots of conflict. Back in, 2008, we had over 1,250 people killed in the post-election violence, 60,000 maimed and over a half a million displaced. Coming up to these elections, now we have completed over 60 workshops right across all those hotspots. So what are we really focusing on is preparing the influential opinion shapers in those environments with the skill sets, right, to analyse what has caused conflict in the past and what can be, in terms of structures and institutions, improved to ensure that violence doesn't happen in the upcoming elections. So we go in there, we're training them people, and we're also helping them to devise action plans. It's their community and they have an obligation and they have a right to ensure that all the institutions are in place in terms of election preparedness for the prevention of election violence and to ensure that we have fair and just elections.
That was Father Patrick Devine, the founder of the Kenya-based Shalom Center for Conflict Resolution and Reconciliation. He was speaking to VOA's Ruben Chama in Nairobi. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer Joe Gill, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America. VOA.
To our audience on VOA's FM in Accra, Ghana, we'll be off the air for 3 days of July 20th, 21st, and 22nd to do necessary technical repairs. We will resume our broadcast on July 23rd. However, you can still listen to VOA's radio programming on our shortwaves, 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band. We are also online at voanews.com. Your friends at VOA regret the temporary loss of our FM broadcast on those days.